a real Madame Blavatsky, please stand up.
Well, thank you very much, Betty. This evening, as Betty told you, we're going to talk a little bit about Madame Blavatsky. And it's interesting that this evening has come at a very interesting time because we are exactly halfway between two major anniversaries. 2 days ago was the Buddhist festival of Vesak. And Vesak is the anniversary of the Buddha's birth, enlightenment, and death. Okay? Celebrated all over the Buddhist world. And that will be relevant in just a moment. I'll explain why. And 2 days from now is White Lotus Day, the anniversary of Blavatsky's death. Now, theosophists tend to be, in the eyes of most of the world, peculiar people, in that we do not celebrate birthdays. We celebrate death days. And you may wonder why that is. Well, I'll tell you why that is. When somebody is born, you don't know what their lives are going to be like, right? You just do not know how it's all going to work out. But by the time somebody dies, you know what life they have lived. And so we tend to celebrate death days, celebrating the great productivity of the lives of those people whom we remember. And that's certainly true of H.P. Blavatsky. Blavatsky asked that her memorial service, her funeral, be very simple, and she requested only that two passages be read at it. She asked that something be read from the Bhagavad Gita, which is the great Indian work of spirituality. It is to India what the Gospels are to Western culture. And she asked that a passage be read from a poem by Sir Edwin Arnold, The Light of Asia, which is about the life of the Buddha. Right? So at the end of my remarks this evening, I am going to read two passages, one from the Gita, one from The Light of Asia, and I'm going to read a third passage. These are all short ones. And the third passage is the obituary for H.P. Blavatsky, which was published in a New York newspaper 2 days after her death. And so we will close the meeting this evening with this memory of H.P.B. in the pattern that she herself asked us to observe. Now, H.P.B.'s life was a remarkable one, and we don't have time this evening to do anything like touch upon all of it. What I'm going to do is to read you some passages from her letters and comment on them. And I have chosen some short passages from a number of different letters to try to show you the multifacets of this woman, right? She was a many-sided person. And she is different with almost every correspondent. And you may say, oh, good heavens, doesn't that show she's insincere? By no means. What it shows is that she did what... interruption. I spent most of my life as a teacher of English in universities. And although I... toward the end of my career, I was a research professor and didn't get to teach very much. Almost to the very end, I taught a course of freshman English once a year because I thought that the freshmen ought to have senior professors teaching them and not just graduate students. And one of the things you always tell freshman students when they are set out to write is, don't just sit down with a blank piece of paper in front of you and write to that paper. Write to somebody, right? Have an audience and address the audience, right? That's the only way to communicate. Well, H.P. Blavatsky always had her audience in mind. She was interested in people, and she talked to people. And so she talked in terms which that the people who she was speaking with could understand. And we'll see that, I think, in some of these letters. She was born in Russia, in the southern part of Russia, in 1831. Her family were upper-class Russians. Her grandmother was a princess of the Russian royal house. That doesn't really mean as much as it would, say, in England, because in Russia, every descendant of a prince or princess is a prince or princess. Right? That's not true in England, right? But nevertheless, her grandmother was a princess, and beyond that, she was a very famous scientist, not obviously a professional scientist, but she corresponded with scientists all over Europe and was highly regarded. Blavatsky's mother was a novelist. She wrote novels about the plight of women in Russian society. She was known as the George Sand of Russia because she wrote that kind of domestic novel. Blavatsky's father was a soldier in the Russian army. He was in the cavalry. And Blavatsky learned to ride a horse as a young girl. Not the way ladies were supposed to ride horses in Russia and every place else. She rode them astride, right? Because she learned to ride from the soldiers. Quite a remarkable woman. She got married at the age of 18, much against her will, but it was her own fault. She was a very headstrong woman, girl and woman, all of her life. And she had a companion, a governess who taught her French and the piano and sewing and all of those skills that ladies of her class were supposed to have. But occasionally the governess got very annoyed with Blavatsky because of her strong will. And once the governess simply lost her temper and said to her, "Helena, you will never get yourself a husband. You've got such a vile disposition. Even that old Blavatsky over there that you make fun of wouldn't marry you." That was a challenge, right? So Blavatsky set out, Helena set out to get old Blavatsky to propose to her. And she succeeded. And as soon as she succeeded, she realized, "Oh, what have I done?" And she tried to back out of it. But the family wouldn't let her because old Blavatsky was a family friend. And for her, and she led him on. And so then now to break off the engagement would have been a disgrace to the family. So they insisted she go through with it. She tried to run away twice. And the family sent after and caught her and brought her back. She did finally marry Nikifor Blavatsky. And at the church service, which was a typical Russian Orthodox church service, they asked that typical question, which used to be asked in all of our marriage services until very recently: "Do you promise to love, honor, and obey?" And Blavatsky answered in a voice which was heard throughout the whole church, "Indeed, I shall not." But the priest went ahead and married her anyway. But she didn't. When they went on their honeymoon, the whole family went on the honeymoon, all right? You know, all the relatives went with Nikifor and Helena on the honeymoon. And Blavatsky tried to run away on the honeymoon trip as well, but they caught her and brought her back. Well, she stayed with old Blavatsky for 2 or 3 months, and then she ran away again, and this time she went back to her grandfather. Her mother had died when she was a teenager, when she was fairly young. And her father was in the army, so he was always being posted off places. So really she grew up in her grandparents' house. So she ran back to her grandparents' house, and they said, "What are we going to do with you? We have to ship you off to your daddy, who was in St. Petersburg." So they got a whole gaggle of servants to escort her. And on the way, what did she do? She gave them the slip. And she caught a boat which took her to Constantinople. She is 18 years old, and she begins world travels. An 18-year-old woman traveling alone, right, in the mid-19th century. Unheard of, particularly a woman of her class. Well, she traveled all around, and she learned a lot of things. Eventually, she came back to Russia and spent a fair amount of time, a number of years, in the Caucasus, in the south of Russia, in Georgia. That's not my Georgia. I'm from Georgia. That's their Georgia. And there she studied with some native magicians who were really shamans. And she learned a lot from them. And she had a very interesting experience, which, in fact, she wrote to her family about. And this is the first extract from a letter, which I want to read. And when she's reporting to her family the very strange experience she had, which was one of dissociation, right? When she was two people. Whenever I was called by name, I opened my eyes upon hearing it and was myself in every particular. As soon as I was left alone, I relapsed into my usual half-dreamy condition and became somebody else. In cases when I was interrupted during a conversation in the latter capacity, when she was somebody else, she had conversations, right? But not with anybody in the room, with invisible companions. In cases when I was interrupted during a conversation in the latter capacity, say at half a sentence spoken by either me or some of my visitors, invisible, of course, to any other, for it was I alone to whom they were realities, no sooner did I close my eyes than the sentence which had been interrupted continued from the word it was stopped at. When awake and myself, I remembered well who I was in my second capacity and what I was doing. But when I was somebody else, I had no idea of who was H.P. Blavatsky. I was in another far-off country. I had quite another individuality with no connection at all with my actual life. So this is a very shamanistic-like experience she had. Now, that experience came to a kind of head at one point in her life in 1865, when she was in her early 30s. And this crisis, we don't know much about it. In later years, she said that whatever happened in 1865, we don't know what it was, whatever it was, completely changed her life, right? And that there was an unbridgeable gulf between the Blavatsky before that period and the Blavatsky afterward, mainly because she came into complete control of herself at that time. And at that time, she wrote another letter to her family in which she said, "Now I will never be subjected any longer to external influences. The last vestige of my psychophysiological weakness is gone, to return no more. I am cleansed and purified of that dreadful attraction to myself of stray spooks and ethereal entities. I'm free, free thanks to them whom I now bless at every hour of my life." Right? So that was a real turning point for her, and she comes in to complete control of her own abilities. She had remarkable psychic abilities from the time she was a child, but she didn't really control them. And that's what got her into that dissociated state. And now she's out of that. All right, now, one of the things she did after that, she went on more world travels, and she finally ended up in Cairo, where she decided to form an organization for the investigation of spiritualism, which was very big at the time, right? Spiritualism, modern spiritualism, began in the United States, but it spread all over Europe and into many other parts of the world. And she decided to form an organization to investigate that, and she gave it a name. It was the Société Spirite, which means the Spiritualist Society. It didn't go anywhere. It was a complete failure. She was never able to get honest mediums to work with, and finally it was entirely fell apart. But she wrote a letter to her family describing what happened at the breakup of the Société Spirite, this abortive organization. And this gives you another view of Blavatsky. She writes her relative. She's been talking about the organization and all of the problems they had and its final failure. And she says, "To wind up the comedy with a drama, I got nearly shot by a madman, a Greek clerk who had been present at only two public seances we held, and got possessed, I suppose, by some vile spook. He premised by running about the bazaars and streets of Cairo with a cocked revolver, screaming that I had sent to him during three nights running a host of shamans, of spirits who were attempting to choke him. He rushed into my house with his revolver, and finding me in the breakfast room, declared that he had come to shoot me, but would wait until I'd done with my meal. It was very kind of him. For in the meanwhile, I forced him to drop his pistol and to rush out once more of the house, from the house. He is now shut up in a lunatic asylum, and I swear to put an end forever to such public seances. They are too dangerous, and I am not practiced and strong enough to control the wicked spooks that not may approach my friends during such meetings." Okay. Another little view of her. Now, she comes to America in 1873. She had gone to Paris intending to settle down and live in Paris, where she had a cousin and other family members and friends. But she'd been in Paris for only a very short time when she got a letter from her teacher, or a message from her teacher, instructing her to go to America. And she had such confidence in that teacher that she went right out and bought a ticket on the ship and left 2 days later for New York. She arrived in New York with practically no money. She lived in a cooperative house for working women in New York, and she did odd jobs. She painted neckties for men. She designed greeting cards. She did some embroidery. She supported herself like that for a while. Eventually what happened was that actually her father had died about the time she came from America, but she didn't find out about it for some while, and he left her some money. So then she had enough to live off for a while. In America, she got very much involved with spiritualism, which was very big here. And she was not particularly pleasing to the spiritualists because she recognized that a good bit of spiritualist phenomena was fraudulent, and she didn't hesitate to say so. She also thought that some of it was quite genuine, but she thought it wasn't what the spiritualists thought it was. There were different causes for what they thought. But she got into quite close terms with a number of spiritualists, one of whom was a woman by the name of Louisa Andrews. And Louisa Andrews got very very closely in touch with Blavatsky. We don't have any of Louisa Andrews' letters or to Blavatsky or hers to Louisa Andrews, but Louisa Andrews also wrote to a mutual friend of theirs, Professor Hiram Corson, who was a professor of English at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. I have to ask my wife about things. She's the one who remembers everything. And Louisa Andrews quoted Blavatsky's letters to Hiram Corson, and so we've got that kind of thing. And in one of her letters to Corson, Louisa Andrews tells about a particularly interesting letter she got from Blavatsky. Louisa had written to HPB about a man who she was afraid of, who maybe it was a kind of stalker or something of that sort, right? But if someone who was a man who was intimidating her, and this is Blavatsky's response to that. "Fiddledy-stick, Lady Medarlin. I defy spirit or mortal, god or demon, to become dangerous to me. I was never controlled and never will be. I don't know a will on earth that would not break like glass in contact or conflict with mine." And Louisa Andrews' comment on this to Hiram Corson was, what a woman she is. And that's about right. Finally, she met in America Henry Steele Alcott, after whom our national headquarters is named. And together with some other people, they founded the Theosophical Society in New York City in 1875. And about the time of the foundation of the Theosophical Society, HPB wrote to her relatives in Russia a letter which will show a completely different side of her, right, from the sides we have seen from the quotations I've made so far. She wrote actually this to her sister Vera. She and her younger sister Vera were very, very close. HPB wrote, "Humanity has lost its faith and its higher ideals. Materialism and pseudoscience have slain them. The children of this age have no longer faith. They demand proof, proof founded on a scientific basis. And they shall have it. Theosophy, the source of all human religions, will give it to them." Okay? That's a rather different kind of Blavatsky. She began shortly after the foundation of the society writing her first big book, which was called Isis Unveiled by the time it was published. Big two-volume book. Its first printing was only 1,000 copies, and they were sold before the book was printed. So they had to rush into a second printing. It became a very influential book. And she wrote to Vera, her sister again, about the experience she had in writing this book. And this again shows another side of HPB. "Well, Vera, believe it or not, some enchantment is upon me. You can hardly imagine in what a charmed world of pictures I live. I am writing Isis. Not writing, rather copying out and drawing that which she personally is showing me. Really, it seems to me as if the ancient goddess of beauty in person leads me through all the lands of bygone centuries which I have to describe. I am sitting with my eyes open, and to all appearances, see and hear everything real and actual around me." She wasn't in a trance or anything of that sort, perfectly conscious. "And yet at the same time, I see and hear that which I write. I feel short of breath. I'm afraid to make the slightest movement for fear the spell might be broken. Slowly, century after century, image after image float out of nowhere and pass before me as if in a magic panorama. And meanwhile, I put them together in my mind, fitting in epochs and dates, and know positively there can be no mistake. It stands to reason it is not I who do all this." She was incidentally had no formal education of any kind, right? Only what women of the upper class would have had, which was social graces. "It stands to reason it's not I who do all this, but my ego." And by ego here, this is a kind of technical, not the ego, not the word ego as we use it. It means the higher self, the real self within one. That's what she means by it here. "The highest principles that live in me. And even then, with the help of my guru, my teacher, who helps me in everything." Okay, and that's the way she wrote her big stuff, both Isis and later, her great work, The Secret Doctrine. Now, I want to give you a completely different view of HPB. One of the people that she corresponded with was an Englishman by the name of C.C. Massey. Massey had come to America to investigate spiritualism, because America was the birthplace of spiritualism. And he was here, and he met Alcott, Colonel Alcott, who had reported on spiritualism and published a book on it. And he and Alcott got to be pretty good friends. And Massey also met HPB. Massey was in America at the time the Theosophical Society was formed, and he became one of the founding members of the society. But he went back home to London. Now, Massey is an interesting character. He is a man of the world, a bon vivant, something, I'm afraid to say, of a womanizer as well. He was a club man in England. In London, there are certain men's clubs. These are very fashionable, very difficult to get into, and very powerful groups because of their smallness and cohesiveness. He belonged to all of the best clubs in London. And all of those clubs are located in the West End of London, which is the fashionable side of London. Do you all see the English soap opera EastEnders, which has played in America? Well, EastEnders is the unfashionable side, right? That's the Cockney side of London. West End is the upper class side. Two of the clubs he belonged to were the Athenaeum, named for Athena, and the Savile. And these were two of the ritziest, poshest of all the men's clubs. I'm mentioning all this because it's referred to in the letter that I'm about to read to you. Massey was also very much interested in Neoplatonism and the early Greek Neoplatonic philosophers like Porphyry and Iamblichus, and he was interested in Hermetic philosophy. All of these things are alluded to in the opening paragraph. Here's the way she begins her letter to him. "Hail, son of the West," end. "Adept of the Athenaeum, seer of the Savile. May your shadow never diminish, but dazzle the Elmo with its unfailing brilliance." The Elmo is probably St. Elmo's light, which is an electrical phenomenon that plays all around on ships. "Now that I have my infernal book off my hands," she just finished Isis Unveiled, "my heart yearns after the transatlantic brace of Iamblico Apollonians and Porphyritico Hermeticists. Are they treading with stone-proof and fireproof soul, S-O-L-E, the rugged path of truth, or wandering in the enticing fields of sense and juvenile fantasy?" And she goes on actually to tease him about some romantic involvements she knew he was involved in, which I am not going to read. She goes on to talk about a mutual acquaintance of theirs by the name of Cora Tappan, who was a medium and very active in the spiritualist movement and a very prolific writer, whom HPB thought not very much of. "Of all the flapdoodles, Cora Tappan's last is the greatest. Did you read her masterly dissection of the word occultism? Or her symbolism on the mother, the letter M, and the religion of the ancients? Oh, really, the woman seems to have a verbomania. She gallops furiously through the dictionaries, clutching adjectives, nouns, and verbs with both hands as she passes, and crams them into her mouth. It's a perfect Niagara of spiritual flapdoodle." That kind of business of HPB was not unusual. Even at the end of her life, after she met Annie Besant, whom she really only met during the last few years of her life, and Annie Besant became her spiritual successor, they were at a meeting of the Blavatsky Lodge, which had been formed in London and named for HPB, and some spiritual descendant of Cora Tappan's was there giving a talk which was just full of nonsense. And HPB bore it as long as she could. And then she whispered to Annie Besant with a whisper the whole room could hear, "Oh, Annie, for God's sake, stop her." And then finally, in another paragraph, she goes on to talk about a very famous event in the society's history and indeed in America. The first public cremation in the United States was done by the Theosophical Society. There was a rather seedy Austrian nobleman by the name of the Baron de Palm, and he was genuinely a baron, and he was a nobleman from Austria, but he was penniless, and he had traveled around the United States trading on his nobility to get to be hosted, right, by people all over. He ended up in New York and met Alcott and Blavatsky and joined the Theosophical Society and told them about all of his castles in Europe and about all of the gold mines he owned in America and all of the land he had. And he said he was going to leave it all to the Theosophical Society for the good work they were doing. And all he asked was that when he died, they would cremate him. He wanted to be cremated. And so they said, yes, they would do that. Well, the Baron de Palm died, all right. And Alcott set out to find all of these great things he had left to the society. Well, it turned out there were castles in Europe, but they didn't belong to the Baron de Palm. They belonged to his family. So they weren't his. He had shares in some gold mines out west, but the mines had turned out not to have any gold in them. So the shares were just paper and worth nothing more. In fact, only thing the Baron de Palm had was were a group of shirts, dress shirts, which he had borrowed from Alcott and had picked Alcott's name out of. Alcott had embroidered his name into his shirts, and that was all the Baron had. Nevertheless, the Society made a promise, so they put on what was a magnificent funeral for him. It was done at one of the big Masonic temples in New York City. It was reported in newspapers all over the country, and then they started out to arrange for his cremation. Well, how do you cremate somebody in a country where there is no tradition of cremation? You can't just, you know, put a pile of wood on the Hudson River and light it. That won't do. As it happened, Alcott discovered a crematory that had been built in Pennsylvania by a doctor, Lemoyne, his name was, for his own use. He believed in cremation, and there was no way to get it done, so he built his own crematory for himself. But it hadn't been used yet because the doctor was still alive. But Alcott got permission to use the Lemoyne crematory to cremate the Baron de Palm, and he was indeed cremated there. And again, it caused an immense sensation in the newspapers of the time, reported newspapers all over the United States. Well, she writes, it took a while to arrange that cremation, right? So they had to sort of keep the Baron's body on ice for a couple of months while they did this. And Blavatsky writes to Massey about that event. The cremation of the old Baron will take place next month, if nothing prevents. He must be a pretty boy to look at now. The newspapers begin ringing bells already. And when the thing comes off, you will see the liveliest excitement that this nation has ever produced. I've got a good mind to cremate myself in the sight of the public together with him, or rather what remains of him, for by now he has turned into a baronial broth. And then I will resuscitate myself phoenix-like. Okay, well, that's a different view of Blavatsky, right? And now I want to give you still a different view of her. She kept in correspondence with her Russian family all the time, and she was particularly fond of one of her nieces, who was the daughter of Vera, right? And this is a letter. I'm going to read just a little bit, some short passages from a letter that she wrote to this niece. My much beloved niece and dear sheep of the golden fleece. That's clearly an allusion to something, and we don't know what it is, right? The golden fleece, of course, is Jason, the Argonauts, who went in search of the golden fleece. But what the connection with the niece is, we don't know. My much beloved niece and dear sheep of the golden fleece, in spite of your progress in algebra, it is evident, my dear, that you are far from having studied mathematics and geometry sufficiently, as you do not know that the whole is equal to the sum of all the parts taken together, or that the lesser cannot contain the greater. In the language of mere unlettered mortals, all this means that it is impossible for your aunt, though she does enjoy the reputation of an Eastern Magus, to write more letters a day than she now succeeds in writing, often depriving herself of sleep. However, I do not want to give you the impression that I intend to deprive myself of a correspondence with such a learned Latinist and algebraist as you show yourself to be. My next work, we shall write together, and we shall call it The Fifth Dimension of Space as it exists between the cities of New York and Tiflis, which is where the niece lived, from the point of view of an American aunt and a Tiflis niece, etc., in 9 volumes and 3.5 chapters. Okay, the letter goes on like that. It's a very playful letter, very joking letter, very fond of this niece. At one point she says, and you must not forget that the day I left Tiflis, the niece was a little girl then, right? That was years and years ago. She's in her teens now. You must not forget that the day I left Tiflis, you howled so that all the block heard you. And having crawled under a bed, you cried, Auntie, you are a fool, you are. This is my last impression of my affectionate niece. And then she gets on to the end and says, and how is Papa? Kiss the tip of his nose for me. You were my pet when you were a baby. Now I hope I shall have a chance to make pets of you all. Your loving American uncle of female sex, H. Blavatsky. They had a little game in which they were brothers or that sort. Okay, that's another one. Now let me read a little bit from another letter, and this one she wrote to her aunt Nadezhda. The aunt was actually only 2 or 3 years older than Helena was herself. You know, it's how you get that generation difference. So they were really of age of sisters. But because Nadezhda was her aunt, she's very respectful of Nadezhda. Moreover, Nadezhda was a very devout Russian Orthodox Catholic, and did not approve of what Helena was doing. She thought Helena was endangering her immortal soul by the things she was doing. So Blavatsky is constantly trying to persuade Aunt Nadezhda that it's all right. And this is just a brief extract from one of many letters to the aunt on this. You were wrong in expressing the opinion, my friend, that I only cast a glance towards Christ, but in reality yearn for the Buddha. I look straight into the eyes of Christ, as well as of Gautama the Buddha. That one of them lived 25 centuries ago and the other 19 does not make the slightest difference to me. I see in both of them the identical divine spirit. Neither Christ, nor Gautama the Buddha, nor the Hindu Krishna have ever preached any dogmas. All right. Finally, Blavatsky and Alcott decided that they would go to India, that that was the best, most fertile field for their work. And so they set out to go there, leaving at the very end of 1878. They paused for a few weeks in England on the way to visit. There was a theosophical group in England by that time, and they visited C.C. Massey and other theosophers in England. And the last letter in this volume, which is the early correspondence of Blavatsky, is a note she wrote to Vera, to Sister Vera, just before getting on the ship to sail out of Liverpool. They would have gone down through the Straits of Gibraltar, down through Suez Canal, around Arabia, and on to Bombay. And this is the note she wrote. Oh, there's a reference in it to a portrait. It was very common in those days. People were constantly exchanging photographs of themselves. Right? And there's a lot about that in the letters. They sent pictures all the time to people, and that's a reference here. I start for India. Providence alone knows what the future has in store for us. Possibly these portraits shall be the last. Do not forget your orphan sister, now so in the full meaning of the word. Goodbye. We start from Liverpool on the 18th. May the invisible powers protect you all. I shall write from Bombay if I ever reach it. Helena. I think that's touching. Very touching. Okay, this is only a sample of what we get in these early letters of Blavatsky. But they show her in a way that you do not see her from her published writings, right? Because in her published writings, she was putting forth a persona, which all writers do, right? But in her private letters, she showed aspects of herself. Sophisticated is when she writes to Massey. Playful is when she writes to the niece. Touching and reverent is when she writes to her aunt. Right? Chatty is when she writes to Vera. I think the letters show her as a wonderfully rounded human being. Right? With all of the foibles, I shouldn't say that we have got, maybe some of you don't have any, all of the foibles that I've got, and all of the wonderful strengths and virtues that one would hope to find in a person. So these letters show her as a fully developed, imperfect, but admirable human being. And now what I'd like to do is to close with those passages which HPB asked be read on White Lotus Day. The first is from the Bhagavad Gita, Discourse 2, and this is from Annie Besant's translation. The Blessed Lord said, "Thou grievest for those that should not be grieved for, yet speakest words of seeming wisdom. The wise grieve neither for the living nor for the dead. For never at any time, verily, was I not, nor thou, nor all these princes of men, nor verily shall we ever cease to be hereafter. As a man casting off worn-out garments taketh on new ones, so the dweller in the body, casting off worn-out garments, enters into new ones. He does not die when the body dies. For certain is death for the born, and certain is birth for the dead. Therefore, over the inevitable, thou shouldst not grieve. Beings are unmanifest in their origin, manifest in their midmost state. Unmanifest likewise are they in dissolution. What room then for lamentation? This dweller in the body of everyone is ever invulnerable. Therefore, thou shouldst not grieve for any creature." Second, from Sir Edward Arnold's Light of Asia, the ending of the poem. "Here endeth what I write, who loved the Master for his love of us. A little knowing, little have I told, touching the Teacher and the ways of peace. Ah, blessed Lord, O high Deliverer, forgive this feeble script which doth thee wrong, measuring with little wit thy lofty love. Ah, lover, brother, guide, lamp of the law, I take my refuge in thy name and thee. I take my refuge in the law of good. I take my refuge in the order, Om. The dew is on the lotus. Rise, great sun, and lift my leaf and mix me with the wave. Om Mani Padme Hum. The sunrise comes. The dewdrop slips into the shining sea. And finally, the obituary for Blavatsky, published in the New York Tribune on May 10th, 1891, 2 days after her death. Few women in our time have been more persistently misrepresented, slandered, and defamed than Madame Blavatsky. But though malice and ignorance did their worst upon her, there are abundant indications that her life work will vindicate itself, that it will endure, and that it will operate for good. She was the founder of the Theosophical Society, an organization now firmly and fully established, which has branches in many countries, East and West. For nearly 20 years, she had devoted herself to the dissemination of the doctrines, the fundamental principles of which are of the loftiest ethical character. Madame Blavatsky held that the regeneration of mankind must be based upon the development of altruism. In this, she was one with the greatest thinkers, not alone of the present day, of all time. The lesson which was constantly impressed by her was assuredly that which the world most needs and has always needed, namely the necessity of subduing self and of working for others. The work of Madame Blavatsky has already borne fruit and is destined, apparently, to produce still more marked and salutary effects in the future. Thus, Madame Blavatsky has made her mark upon the time. And thus, too, her works will follow her. Someday, if not at once, the loftiness and purity of her aims, the wisdom and scope of her teachings will be recognized more fully, and her memory will be accorded the honor to which it is justly entitled. I thank all of you for being here this evening for this little talk, which comes between Vesak, the great festival of the Buddhist calendar, and White Lotus Day, in which we recall and are thankful for the productive and inspiring life of Helena Petrovna Blavatsky. Thank you.